Hi everyone. Welcome to the Lavender Fix podcast. You are listening to episode 4 and I'm your host, Sabreen Hazik. Now, as you can tell by the title of this episode, it's not going to be like the rest. In fact, this episode is going to be all about straight up facts. And I have to be very honest with you. I was very nervous, and in fact, I am still very nervous about recording this episode today, just because I don't want to say anything insensitive unintentionally, of course, and I don't want to state anything incorrectly. Now, George Floyd, a 46-year-old black man, died in Minneapolis when a policeman knelt on his neck for over 8 minutes. And this was despite the victim's cries of, "I can't breathe." Now, as you know, the footage of this incident has sparked widespread protests across the United States and the globe, with demonstrators saying that this was yet another example of black people being targeted by authorities because of their race. And protesters have stood off with police since the incident took place, which was on the 25th of May, chanting, "I can't breathe, don't shoot," and "Black Lives Matter." So evidently a very strong narrative is emerging from these tragedies of racially motivated targeting of black Americans by the police force. And it is backed up by a new report, which was released by the Department of Justice, and it's on the city of Baltimore. And this report found that black residents of low-income neighborhoods are more likely to be stopped and searched by police officers, even if white residents are statistically more likely to be caught carrying guns and drugs. So what is the Black Lives Matter movement all about? The Black Lives Matter movement is a powerful movement that was founded in 2013, and this was following the acquittal of a man named George Zimmerman, who was accused of murdering Trayvon Martin, a 17-year-old African-American boy, 17. And this movement was founded with the aim of eradicating white supremacy and also building local power to intervene in violence that is inflicted on black communities by the state. Today, I have with me my very good friend, Kimberly A. Houston, who is the owner and principal consultant at Pure Health Prosperity, and she administers consultations in the area of holistic personal development. Kim, I am so grateful to you for joining me today. Thank you so much for being here and for agreeing to share your thoughts on the larger context of the Black Lives Matter movement, and also for agreeing to educate us all on the role each one of us can play to fight this fight with our black brothers and sisters. Welcome to the show, Kim.
Thank you so much for having me on, Sabreen.
Of course. I'm really grateful, Kim. I know that we're in the middle of so much right now, and highly indebted that you took the time to be here.
Oh, thanks again for having me. Like you said, it's really an important time in all of our lives as individuals. I mean, we already had COVID-19 that we were all, you know, experiencing. And then we now have this kind of extra layer of, you know, the reemergence of a lot of, you know, of the pain of what it means to be, you know, an American and an African descended person of the diaspora in general. And so it's almost, I feel, a good time to have the conversation because we are already in a place where everybody is stopped, their lives are stopped. And so as a result of us, you know, stopping all of the things that usually keep us busy and distracted, you know, it almost forces us to really like think about and express and to feel what's happening right now. And I have hope that great change will happen as a result of us all collectively doing the work that needs to be done.
Absolutely. Now, thank you again, Kim. And okay, so let's kickstart this very important discussion, which is, Kim, in the past few days, what I've noticed is that a lot of folks have been debating on the use of two different hashtags related to the Black Lives Matter movement, right?
Yes.
I am pretty sure by now you know which ones I'm referring to. And I've been using Black Lives Matter since the beginning of time, because facts. However, the opposition of Black Lives Matter have taken to responding by saying that all lives matter. And my first reaction to this was that the use of the hashtag All Lives Matter, it downplays the disproportionate racism and police brutality which is experienced by Black people, right?
Yes.
And the entire point of Black Lives Matter is to really highlight the extent to which Black lives haven't mattered in this country, right?
Definitely.
And I'd like to give you a quick example by this woman named Rachel Cargill. And Rachel is a public academic, writer, and lecturer. And her activism and academic work are basically rooted in providing intellectual discourse, tools, and resources that explore really that intersection between race and womanhood. And she recently stated that if a patient was being rushed to the ER after an accident, and they pointed to their mangled leg and said, "This is what matters right now," and the doctor saw all the other scrapes and bruises that weren't as pressing in other areas and countered and said, "But all of you matters," right? Wouldn't there be a question as to why this doctor is not showing urgency in aiding what is most at risk? And it's as simple as that. So, Kim, my question to you is, if all lives matter, why do we have these disparities?
Oh, man. I think, you know, the unfortunate thing about all of this, right? Because the history is so deep and it's so long. And it's easy to want to put butterfly stitches or a Band-Aid on a wound that is gushing and literally needs hours of surgery, right? Even along the lines of, you know, the analogy that you just gave.
Right.
And so what it means for a surgeon to have to spend hours preparing for the surgery, making sure that all of the proper tools are in place in order to for the surgery to be a success, making sure that all of the proper nurses and staff are in the room, making sure that the proper level of sterility is in the room so that that patient could come out of the room successful and healthy and healed. If that surgeon doesn't want to do that work, then they would downplay the severity of the injury and say, "That doesn't require surgery. Just put a Band-Aid on it, go home, right? Take two Tylenol and call me in the morning." And so it's a similar situation when we talk about Black Lives Matter versus All Lives Matter, which is, it's a lot easier to not have to take responsibility for what's happening to African Americans in this country by saying, "Oh, all lives matter." Like, why do we have to put a specific, you know, emphasis on Black lives when all lives matter? Because they don't want to take the time to delve into the concerns of people of African descent in this country, because it would require them to have to do the work.
Correct.
And it's easier to just live your comfortable life and go on with the status quo than to really go into that incision and do all of the necessary work in order for true healing to take place.
Right. Right. I mean, Kim, I had a lump in my throat as you were, you know, it's really hard. And when I was, even before I started recording this episode, I was sharing with our listeners that it's so difficult to talk about something like this. And as someone who's not from the Black community, you know, I've been trying to process all this information. And one of the reasons I did reach out to you was, you know, what you just shared, it was such a nuanced answer that even for me, as you speak, this is an educational experience, really. So 100% agree with everything you just said. Now, in this era when racism, xenophobia, anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, all of these things are on the rise across the globe, right? It is important that all children from all backgrounds learn and practice non-discrimination. And education is the best tool for tackling racism and discrimination and to make sure that we're building inclusive societies, right? That's my belief.
Yeah, definitely.
And children are leaders of the future, and they can and should be taught early about equality, respect, and tolerance. Mm-hmm. And because we are responsible personally for what we pass on to the future generation. So
definitely.
Do you think, Kim, that educational institutions in this age and time are taking the right steps to combat racism and discrimination in, you know, the current system? So what I'm trying to say is that are they taking the right steps to really combat existing racism?
No, mm-hmm. They're not. And I think I want to begin by just saying, you know, I wanted to, you know, just mention this quote by, you know, wonderfully renowned Nigerian author who, you know, is now passed. His name is Chinua Achebe. And he had this this phrase that he said, which is, until the lions have their own historians, the history of the hunt will always glorify the hunter.
That's beautiful.
And the reality is that education begins at home. You know, our parents in our communities, our grandparents, our aunts, our uncles, you know, our neighbors, those are really our first educators. And so if you are raised in a home where your, you know, primary support group has this particular opinion about another group of people, these are the people that you love. These are the people that you know love you. These are the people who have taken care of you. So it's going to be natural for us, especially in our formative years, to think that everything that comes out of our mom's mouth, comes out of our dad's mouth, comes out of our grandma, our grandpa's mouth, is the truth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to the point where even as you venture out into more formal education and you hear things in your more formal education, our natural inclination is going to be, that can't be true. That my mom told me something different.
Mm-hmm.
My dad told me something different, you know? And then to add to that, when you look at the history that's being taught, right, in these environments, when you look at the history books, you know, I've been a part of a lot of conversations where, you know, they talk about, you know, elementary school, high school history. And when you look in the textbooks and they cover the issue of slavery on the timeline, they have these pictures of slaves smiling and slaves being happy and,
mm-hmm.
you know, all these different things. And it's kind of a form of cognitive dissonance where people, they're like, oh, well, slavery couldn't have been that bad. Oh, well, slaves couldn't have been that miserable. You know what I mean? Oh, you know, white people couldn't have been that cruel.
Right.
But when you read the narratives, firsthand narratives from people from that era, it says a very different thing. Okay. And so in terms of what it means to raise young people in the subsequent generations to be sensitive to the history of their fellow American citizen residents who have had a very different experience, you have to first make sure that you're telling the story accurately.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is that people are, human nature is to want to characterize yourself or characterize your people as being good, as being altruistic, as being having good intention, you know, mm-hmm. as being the hero, as being, you know, people who have the, you know, want to progress, you know, be the initiators and the pioneers of forward progress.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reality of that ambition and how it has negatively affected Native Americans, you know, people of Native descent who were here before, you know, Europeans got here. And then also how that affected the Africans that they brought here
mm-hmm.
will have to cause them to really own the fact that it wasn't as nice and altruistic, even though that might have been the intention, that what actually happened was very far from like sugary and sweet,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Right.
And they have to own that, and they have to own that to their children
mm-hmm.
in order for us to really be in a place where that chasm can be bridged.
Right. Right. And Kim, I remember that you yesterday when we were chatting about you know, the script and how we want to go about the podcast, you mentioned that your daughter had you know, you'd sent her to a college in Maine, and something
high school actually, it wasn't even college. It
yeah,
was a high school.
Can you mm-hmm. share that story with us? I was really like, I'm still a little shook.
I mean, oh my goodness, where do I even begin? So I think I'll begin here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had my first opportunity to drive my daughter up to the school for me to see it before she actually started to attend. And as we drove up to the campus, I should have seen this as an omen, right? I should have seen this as an omen when we crossed the border from New Hampshire into Maine,
mm-hmm.
and there's literally a house to our left with a Confederate flag on the house.
Oh my God.
Like, literally, Confederate flag draped across this house as we crossed the border from Maine to New Hampshire. And although obviously she and I were both taken back by it, you know, the unfortunate reality of what it means to be educated, especially in the Northeast, is that it's almost like a white is right type of situation, where in order for you to get access to good quality education, in order for you to have access to, you know, great resources around education, the reality for especially Black people in the North is that those environments are Black people are few and far between. Mm-hmm. You know, you end up being what they call a token,
mm-hmm.
You know, communities, educational communities that, you know, I want to believe genuinely want to be more inclusive,
mm-hmm.
right? But then what ends up happening is they have a sprinkle of, you know, darker faces in their environments. And then it's like, oh, we're diverse because, you know, we have, you know, 5-1 or 10-1 or 20-1, you know, white people over, you know, people of other races and nationalities. And that's their attempt at being inclusive or diverse,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
And so my daughter goes to this school and would literally mm-hmm. send me screenshots on her phone of classmates with sweatshirts on that have Confederate flags.
That is crazy.
And I'm talking about like literally, you know, they have a fair, you know, up at this particular area. And there was a conversation where, you know, some students of color had some issues with the way that they, you know, were dealing with some issues around race. And there was a post that went up on social media saying, "Do you know what we do to people like you around here?"
What?
Yes.
The audacity, my God.
Yes, and the boldness of doing that on social media.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to the point where, you know, my daughter, you know, being, I guess, like, I don't know if it runs in the bloodline, started a group, you know, started a club to try to bridge those gaps through, you know, education and understanding of the history of Black people in this country. And there are people, frankly, on campus who didn't like it. You know, they didn't like it. And to make a really long story short, they targeted her. And a situation that under other circumstances should have just been a dispute between two teenagers was used to basically get her off the campus because they didn't appreciate the fact that she was highlighting the blatant racism, blatant covert and overt racism that was present on that campus.
And how old are these kids, Kim? How old are these?
Goodness. 14 to 18.
My God, those are really the foundational years.
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, and this kind of goes back to your point of, you know, that there's a difference between education, indoctrination, and deliberate misinformation.
Yes.
For personal gain, and that's exactly that. And what about these, you know, Ivy League colleges? Like, I know in India, it's such a huge deal, and I'm pretty sure even in other countries, to be able to send your kid to an Ivy League college is like the biggest goal in life.
Right.
It's the biggest measurement of success. And so what about some of those colleges with a legacy? Are they, do you think they're taking any tangible steps?
So, I mean, the challenge with where we find ourselves is that when something has been ingrained, there's no such thing as a quick fix. You know, when something has been ingrained for so many centuries, it's unrealistic to believe that it's going to be fixed in a year or in 2 years or in 10 years or 20 years. And I mean, how many years past this are we now?
Right.
And, you know, the challenge becomes, right, because like they say, you'll know a tree by its fruit, right? But the fruit is just the byproduct of the system of the roots. And so therefore, if you have certain aspects at the root of the thing, it's like you almost have to uproot it in order for it to be something different than what it's always been. And so, you know, for when you look at the educational system of this country, right? I mean, even if we just do a little bit of a timeline, right? Yeah. If we look at the timeline from, you know, when, you know, the good old Pilgrims landed on Plymouth Rock, you know, and you go through, you know, what it meant to sign the Declaration of Independence, right? 1776, you know, 4th of July, good old 4th of July, right? All the fireworks. We hold these truths to be self-evident, right? That all men are created equal. Well, definitions matter. So it's like, okay, all men are created equal. But if you don't believe that a Black body is a human, then when you make a statement like all men are created equal, then clearly that statement is not going to refer to people that you do not consider people, right? So then that gets translated into our educational system, because who were sending their children to colleges and universities? White people, white slave owners. When you talk about Ivy League schools, you're talking about elite people, elite white people. So elite white people who either owned slaves themselves or who benefited from the products of slavery, right? Because we have what, industrialization more so in the North and we have production in the South. So when you have factory owners who are buying the cotton or buying the, you know, calico or whatever from the South, these are the people who have the money to send their children to these institutions. Okay. And so by nature, the foundation of these institutions is not only built on slavery from the economic perspective, but it's also built on slavery, honestly, frankly, even from the research perspective, right? Because if African-Americans or African-descended slaves, right, aren't human, then you can perform experiments on them that informs medicine. Right? You can use them as your servants around the campus to maintain the campus, to, you know, to accompany the wealthy slave owners' children of course they're going to bring their slaves with them when they come to school, right?
Correct.
So all of these different aspects of what it meant to be educated in the United States, by default, on all these different levels, inherently includes the intermingling and the intertwining of slavery in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so those things carry, because once again, if we fast forward it to now and we talk about wealth gaps, right? We talk about educational gaps. We talk about how educational systems are comprised. When you look at public education in the United States, right? Public education is funded by real estate taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have affluent communities, right,
mm-hmm.
where the real estate taxes are going toward the education of the children in those communities, versus if you go to poorer neighborhoods, which for a whole lot of other reasons, right,
mm-hmm.
or, inner city neighborhoods, right, where they don't have much property ownership. Because they don't have that property ownership, right, everybody's renting and it's a whole lot more populated, then they don't have the dollars going towards the education of their young people
mm-hmm.
as these more affluent communities. So when you're talking about the rigor, the cost, mm-hmm. right, the admissions processes of these higher level education institutions, by default, they're leaving out a whole population of people.
Right. Yeah, it's not inclusive.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, if you even take it to the extent of looking at the private school education system,
mm-hmm.
like unequivocally, they are very, like, my daughter, the school that I was telling you about in Maine, that was a private school, $44,000 a year.
Oh my God.
And even just, my process of being a parent and wanting my children to have these high levels of education, their screening process is like crazy. The screening process is crazy. You literally have to like write a college essay to get your three-year-old into their institution. They want you to send pictures of your family.
What?
Like, yeah.
What for?
That's a part of their application process.
Hmm.
That's the way that they qualify and quantify whether or not you and your family are a good fit for their institution.
Goodness. And in terms of diversity, Kim, when your daughter was applying and then when she did get through and when she finally got there, what is the diversity ratio like? What was it like? Was the staff representative of,
No, not at all.
So it was all white.
The whole time she was there, I think she had two black teachers.
Wow. In the whole school? Like, that
in
is insane.
School.
Wow. Oh my God. So, I mean, this is, like I said, this is super educational for me because I only moved to the U.S. about 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's not a good feeling. And so now, Kim, we're all well-versed with the fact that hundreds of thousands of Africans, both free and enslaved, they really aided the establishment of the survival of colonies in Americas and the New World.
Yeah.
And throughout the 17th and 18th centuries, there's no denying this, people were kidnapped from the continent of Africa and forced into slavery in the American colonies, right? Mm-hmm. And exploited to work as chattel slave laborers, right? Mm-hmm. And thank you, Kim, for helping me with that. So to give you guys a little bit context, when I was working on my questions, I said to Kim, please feel free to go into the document and just add your perspective and correct anything that seems a bit, odd. And so thank you, Kim, for educating me on the chattel form of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And to explain what that is that a chattel slave is an enslaved person who is owned forever and whose children and children's children are automatically enslaved. So chattel slaves are individuals who are treated as complete property, which is to be bought and sold. And chattel slavery was supported and made legal by European governments and monarchs, right? And then there is another form of slavery, which was indentured servitude. And that's according to Investopedia. Indentured servitude refers to a contract between two individuals in which one person worked not for money, but in exchange of the price of passage to America, right? Mm-hmm. And indentured servitude, which was popular in the United States in the 1600s, was essentially a kind of barter system. So, for example, someone who sought a new life in America, but who could not afford the expensive steamship fare from another country, would contract with a wealthy U.S. landowner to perform a type of work for a fixed period in exchange of for the price of the boat ticket. Right. Mm-hmm. But in the 13th Amendment, when it was adopted on December 18th, 1865, it officially abolished slavery and involuntary servitude, except as punishment for a crime, which to me is still appalling that mm-hmm. there was still that question of, yes, we're abolishing it, but, right, there right. should have never been a but. So, Kim, it's 2020, right? Why is it still that we see this lingering racism and discrimination in a country like America that began during the slavery era? Why are we still holding on to this colonial mindset?
I think the short answer is greed. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at, once again, the roots of everything, right? Mm-hmm. Europeans ventured out to other lands, right, to search for what they could take, mm-hmm. you know, what they could profit from, how they could expand their empires. Mm-hmm. And when you transition that to why they took Africans from the continent, it was because they saw an opportunity. You know, this was, you know, the interesting thing about, even when you talk about the slave trade, is mm-hmm. that it started off as trade. It started off as relationships with Africans. This was, you know, in the time of the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And it started off with Europeans who were now getting into industry, right? Mm-hmm. Going to Africa in order to get palm oil that they used to grease the machines for industrialism. And so as that relationship grew, as all of that started to grow, now they need laborers, right? So then that's when it now transitioned into them taking Africans in order to work toward this whole idea of production, and then, you know, the colonies and cotton and tobacco and all these different things that need to be worked. And, you know, we know, right, buy low, sell high, right? Mm-hmm. So it's money. And so here we are now, and you make this transition to, you know, oh, you know, the 13th Amendment, and slavery is no longer, you know, a thing, right?
Right.
But then absolutely. All these people who were making money off of the Industrial Revolution, they still need to make their money. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not going to say, after all of these years of us using this form of servitude, you know, this form of torture in a lot of respects, right, to make money, now all of a sudden, like, what are they going to do? This has been their whole livelihood since they've been in this country. Mm-hmm. They're not going to just, like, tuck their tail between their legs and say, oh, well, let's do something else. Let's go figure something else out. Right. What they're going to do is they're going to figure out a loophole in the system to be able to continue what they've always been doing. And so when we look at the 13th Amendment, that's exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. That is, like, you know, what do they say? A horse by any other name is still a horse. Mm-hmm. So now, instead of it being called slavery, now they call it the prison industrial complex. The prison industrial complex is not a new idea. Mm-hmm. What they started to do is categorize people, you know, former slaves as lazy. They start to, you'll see a lot of propaganda around now, you know, Black people, can they be trusted, especially in the South, which part of, I mean, some of it is rightful, right? Like, you've kept these people for slaves, you've beat them, you've raped them, you've, you know, you've hung them, you've done all these things to them, and now here they are, they're free. Like, there's going to be a little bit of guilt there. There's going to be some worry there. Like, wow, are these people now going to flip on us? Mm-hmm. And now that they're free, are they going to kill us? You know, yeah. Are they going to, you know, take over our stuff? And so as a result of that fear, there is a consorted effort to start to propagandize people of color as being negative, bad,
violent,
lazy, mm-hmm. you know, criminal, right? Scary, all these different things. And then as you continue to now categorize people as being all these different characteristics, then it causes for them to be arrested, mm-hmm. right? And then as they're arrested, now you can go right back to where you were of using them for free.
Right. And you can't inflict so much pain on someone and then also expect that they'll express grief your way. I just think it's really exactly. bizarre, right? You can't be told exactly. what you should be feeling. So, of course. And so, you know, we have this really powerful movement now, Kim, Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. So what is the ultimate goal for, you know, the so to put it in very simple words, what does the Black community hope to achieve? And what do they want out of the movement?
It's so funny that's such a simple question, mm-hmm. that should have such a seemingly simple answer, that my simple answer is going to have so much complexity to it. Mm-hmm. All we want, all Black people want, is what the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution promised them mm-hmm. from the beginning. You know? Mm-hmm. Like, what does it say? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that men have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Mm-hmm. And how simple is that?
Although that seems like it's so simple, it's like, duh, like, well, that's what we were founded on. This country was founded on freedom. And yet, such a great population of this country who founded this country, you know, who built this country, who built the economic system that this country stands on, doesn't get to enjoy that simple thing that the country was founded on. Mm-hmm. And so what Black people want, what the Black community wants, is to be seen as equals. You know, once again, if you go back to the history, you know, there was this compromise, you know, in 1787, right? It's called the Three-Fifths Compromise. And what the Three-Fifths Compromise said is that Southern states were able to consider each one of their slaves as three-fifths of a whole human being for the purpose of representation in government.
My God.
And for the purpose of taxation. And so think about how before 1787, African Americans weren't seen as human at all. They weren't seen as people at all. And then by 1787, we come up to three-fifths. And so once again, those ideas that are perpetuated throughout history just continue to solidify Black people aren't human. Mm-hmm. And so when you don't believe that someone is a human one-to-one like you, that's the reason why people don't feel like they have to value you or they have to treat you as if you're their equal. Mm-hmm. And so there really needs to be a consorted effort for people to really check their biases at the door. You know, Black people want, first and foremost, for white people to learn the history, know the history, understand that what's going on, look at the facts, not somebody's opinion, not what your mom and your grandmom and your community have told you. Look at the facts. talk to the people, read the narratives of the people who went through this injustice, and believe what they tell you. You know, don't rationalize what they say. Don't sweep it under the rug. Don't minimize it. Don't make it seem like, oh, it can't be that bad. It couldn't have been. No, it was that bad. It was that bad.
Yeah, you can't judge the situation you haven't experienced.
Definitely.
And they have. And I think that I am pretty sure that there is an element of shame that they don't want to acknowledge, maybe. You know, nobody wants to accept the fact, like you mentioned earlier, that, you know, we're much more better off having historical amnesia than teaching our kids about what our ancestors did to all these other people. But I think at the end of the day, it's about acceptance of not just the Black community, but also really accepting the fact that your own ancestors did something that was not correct. And that the future is really in your hands.
Definitely.
You know?
And recognizing that you are still benefiting from what they implemented.
Yep.
Because I think some of where the conversation goes is, well, that was them. That was them. You know, I'm not doing that now. I'm not a racist now. Or, you know, the famous, I don't see color. Right?
Oh my God. Yes.
And that's so false, right? That's so untrue.
Yeah.
And so it's like, no, you are still benefiting. Yeah. You know, when you look at the statistics, and a Black man with a college education has a harder time being employed than a white man with a high school education, that gap between that wealth gap is all about the color of his skin.
Right.
And so that needs to be acknowledged, that even today, although we hope, right, because unfortunately it's sad to say that we do still have people lynching Black people.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's still a thing. Like, lynching is still happening.
Right.
You know, no one is talking about that, that there are still Black bodies that are being found hung from trees. And in those areas where that is found, they say, oh, it must have been a suicide.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is not, like, it... That's the most painful part of it, is that we're not having conversations about trying to get past what happened. We're still having conversations about the fact that what happened is still happening.
Correct. And also came to your point of how people talk about not being averse to the idea of color. I think what people forget is that anti-racism is not about the lack of color. It's about the beauty of diversity, right? And the abundance of different perspectives. I mean, what kind of a world would we be living in if we all had literally the same level of skill and if we had nothing new to add to the conversation? Like this episode, for example, you're bringing in this powerful perspective that I didn't have before, but all thanks to you, I have more information now, and who knows, maybe I'll go back, do more study, buy some more books, and have a fresh perspective that maybe I can share with you, you know? So,
Definitely. Yeah,
it's not about the lack of color. That's very exasperating. I agree. And so, Kim, everything you just said was so... I mean, I am just mind blown. One, with your depth of knowledge, you know?
Thank you.
Really grateful that... And so lucky that I was able to have you here. And Kim, now moving on to the last section of this show, or of the segment, we typically have an advice section. And that is, I would like to ask you that, what is the responsibility of non-Black people in this movement? And how can they be allies? Can you share a few pieces of advice with our listeners?
Most definitely. Mm-hmm. I think it starts with an internal investigation.
Right.
I think it starts with being more self-aware. I think it starts with asking yourself conversations like, do I feel the need to be better or superior to somebody else? And when you ask yourself that question, do I think, I mean, honestly, be frank, get raw. Do I think that I'm better than a black person? Do I honestly think that I'm smarter than a black person? Mm-hmm. You know, ask yourself those questions. Do, when I see a person of color, when I see a black man walk down the street, do I become afraid? Do I think that he's going to rob me? Do I question that? If I see a black person in my neighborhood, do I find myself having an unexplainable kind of sensation in the pit of my gut? And if the answer to those questions is yes, then you are responsible for following that line of thinking and figuring out, why do I feel this way? Why do I feel this way about somebody that I don't know, that I've never met? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Why do I feel this way? And search that out. Like, do that work. Do that work. It starts internally before anything, because I've been in rooms and I've dealt with situations where well-intentioned white people mm-hmm. still were marginalizing the black people that they were trying to help, because at the core of them, they were still ingrained with a superiority. So what they were hoping to be helped was instead received by the people of color as pity.
Right.
And black people do not need to be pitied. Mm-hmm. There's a very big difference between help and pity. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like it begins with doing that self-work, coming to the realization of your own biases, coming to the realization of your own racism, mm-hmm. and addressing yourself first, doing a lot of self-talk, like, what I'm feeling is wrong, what I'm feeling is inaccurate, what I'm feeling is not founded, why do I feel this way? And doing the internal work that you may never speak to somebody else to change that internal conversation.
Right.
I think that's the first thing that needs to be done. The second thing that I feel needs to be done is flat out education. You know, we live in an internet age. Google is everybody's best friend in terms of what it means for you to look up the history and have a realistic understanding of the foundations of what we are now going through. It is once again your responsibility to do the work. I know that once again, when you and I were planning this episode, we were talking about the fact that unfortunately the burden falls on African Americans a lot to constantly have to educate
Correct.
White people and other cultures about our history and about our struggle and about our experience. Mm-hmm. And take some of that load off of us.
Yeah.
Take some of that load off of us by doing the research yourself. Like, there are enough resources out there for you to be able to come to the table informed without us always having to do that work. But nevertheless, and with that being said, I'm going to take it upon myself to recommend some people and some resources for your followers to follow.
Please.
So that they can do that work. So along those lines, there is a wonderful, wonderful woman by the name of Dr. Joy DeGruy. Her last name is spelled DeGruy. And she actually, that is her website, joydegruy.com. She is the author of a book called Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome. Mm-hmm. And it is, she's a phenomenal person. She does all different types of workshops and resources. I went to her website to prepare for this podcast, and she even has an online course. And she is literally called for all around the world to have these conversations with multicultural rooms about, you know, Black slavery, the Black experience, and what she has named post-traumatic slave syndrome. So she's a really, really great person to start with, Dr. Joy DeGruy. Mm-hmm. Also, there's a woman by the name of Jane Elliott. And I'm not sure if you've ever heard of her experiment that literally was done mm-hmm. in the 60s, right? The blue eyes, brown eyes experiment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Where she separated out her classroom, she's a white woman, separated out her classroom full of white people by those who had blue eyes and those who had brown eyes, and put them even in this little kind of petri dish of an experiment through some of the things that Black people have gone through in this country around discrimination. And she's still, you know, all of her information is still very much on the internet. And her website is also her name, Jane Elliott, last name ELLIOT.com. Mm-hmm. So those are two really great resources and people to follow. And then even when we were talking about education and the history of racism and slavery in higher education, there is a book by a gentleman named Craig Stephen Wilder. And the book is called Ebony and Ivy. Ivy being like Ivy League. So yep. Ebony and Ivy.
I'm definitely getting that.
Mm-hmm. And the subtitle is Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. That's also another really great resource that people can take advantage of. And I would offer as the final resource a documentary that I saw, I mean, over 10 years now, and it's actually available for free right on YouTube. It's called, hold on, I want to say it correctly. It's a film called Maafa 21, and it's spelled M-A-F-F-A 21. You can look that up right on YouTube, and it just really takes you through the issue of Black genocide in the United States and the propaganda, the progression of the propaganda in this country that created a narrative about Black people that they weren't worth living, that it wasn't worth, their lives weren't worth anything. And so those are just a few resources. I am warning you up front, you will be shocked. It is not going to be pretty. It is not going to be sugar-coated and nice and sweet. But in order for us to have real solutions, we have to understand the real problem.
Correct. Kim, thank you so much for taking the time to be here and for sharing your thoughts with us. I couldn't agree more. Justice is far from being achieved, and to be silent is to be complicit. It is your responsibility to become more ethical than the people you grew up around. And truly, the need of the hour is to really challenge generational bigotry, even if it means that you have to call out your parents or correct them, your siblings, or even your close circle of friends. I think that's very critical. And you have to educate your close ones and challenge their prejudice and anti-Black remarks. In fact, you must challenge any kind of racist remarks. And it's also important to really understand that anti-racism is not about the lack of color, but it's about the beauty of diversity and the abundance of different perspectives. This unhealthy obsession with whiteness, it really stems from a more systematic problem, which is the colonial mindset that Kim talked about in this episode. And in an already heavily, heavily led world, don't allow room for discrimination to be normalized. Don't be the beneficiary of this hatred and of this generational bigotry. I always say, and this is my life's motto, that you have to be the change that you want to see in this world. So let's unite, observe, mourn, and really work towards bringing about policy change in the wake of the death of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and many, many others throughout America's long history of racism, because Black lives matter.